Joining us now is the founder and executive director of Liberty and Prosperity, and he'll be talking about Richard Summers for the first half of this hour. Hey, Seth, welcome back to Hurley in the Morning.
Good morning, Harry. And I can't believe that this is actually the 16th year that I'll be doing the Richard Summers ceremony, because when all this started back in 2004, I basically heard a little bit about Richard Summers and in grade school, didn't know that much about him. And I was I just went to the 200th anniversary of his death, September 4th, 2004, to hear his story. And when I heard that remarkable story, I said, gee, this tells us so much. And so the next year, September 4th, I went to the Summers Point Historical Society and said, well, are we going to have the ceremony this year? And they said, well, no, not really. We only had it because it was the 200th anniversary of Richard Summers' death. So I volunteered to help the city and the Historical Society, Sally Hastings, put together a program. And I learned so much more about the story. And then I was asked to do it again for a second year. And so there I was, September 4th of 2006, getting ready to do a presentation. And I said to myself, you know, I can't just give the same speech to the same people. Let me do a little more reading and learn more about the story. And I did. I learned a whole lot more about the story, made a presentation in 2006. The bottom line is, for 16 years, every time I put this program together, I read a little bit more, and I have never gotten the same story twice. There's always more information, always something new to learn. So, and if people are saying, well, how can I talk about Richard Summers and history with all these things going on in the country today, especially in Afghanistan? Why can I talk about the issues that matter most? I can honestly tell you that you, Harry Hurley, and me, Seth Grossman, and most of the people in libertyandprosperity.com probably know more about our enemy in Afghanistan because we learn the history of Richard Summers every year. We probably know more than the people on the Joint Chiefs of Staff, most of our military commanders, most of military intelligence, most of the Biden administration, because we have not only taken the time every year to learn the history of events when we fought basically the same enemy, but we also have open discussions so that when sometimes we get it wrong, we have others correct us until we get it right. And people say, well, how do you know so much about all this stuff? You know, you're not a history professor. Well, the answer is I have discussed this with some of the best history professors, like Chip Reed of Annapolis, who came down for about 10 years and gave his presentation. And he and I disagreed. And you know, he showed where I was wrong in certain areas. I showed where he was wrong. And we got this great insight where we know what's going on. So the bottom line is, this Saturday, September 4th, at 9 o'clock, Liberty and Prosperity will be there to tell the story of Richard Summers. Once again, we'll have Mary Ann Cannon, the artist from Millville, who drew the mural that's on the wall of the library of Summers Point at 801 Shore Road. The ceremony will take place there. There's no charge for it. It's across the street from Charlie's Bar. You could see the paintings. You could see the statue of Richard Summers. And I invite everybody to come to that. And after the event is over, then we'll be paying for the expenses for the postcards like we always do. We'll be at Sal's Cafe, which is 501 New Road in Summers Point, the Groveland Shopping Center. The brunch that pays for our expenses is $25. And if anyone wants to learn more about it, go to libertyandprosperity.com. And that's the introduction. So if I could I give you the new insight that I learned this year that I didn't know before?
Time is yours.
Okay. So basically, for a couple of years, you had the historian Chip Reed, took issue with me when I said that this war and by the way, Richard Summers died fighting what was called the Barbary Pirates of North Africa. And they were very much like the jihadis in that they were at war with the Christian world. And they felt they had the right to attack and enslave anybody who did not accept the Prophet Muhammad as the true prophet. And when American ships were caught in the area, they'd be captured, and the ships would be seized, cargo would be seized, the crew and passengers would be sold into slavery. And that's what they did. This is what had been done in North Africa for basically 1,000 years. And then when Americans, it happened to Americans, we went to fight them. So what the historian Chip Reed said is Grossman, you got it all wrong. They weren't after jihad. This was just their business. Americans were rich. We had these rich ships. They were poor. They took the money. It was simple piracy. And he showed the documents that there were negotiations. Everything was very civil. When the Americans were captured, at first they would not be sold into slavery. They'd be held for ransom. We'd pay the ransom. The Barbary so-called pirates, they had diplomats in London and Paris. Everything was very civilized. So it was a business. But here's the interesting thing that I learned, and this is where it brings us directly to Afghanistan. It's true that by the 1700s, the Barbary, what they call pirates, were the Turkish Empire or the Ottoman Empire, they had gotten soft. They were looking at it as a business. They weren't interested in spreading Islam. They were in it for making money, for getting blonde-haired, blue-eyed women from Iceland, taking them back as slaves for the Sultan. They were smoking hashish. They were very soft, and they were in this cutthroat pirate business. But here's what gets interesting. There was, in the Islamic world, among the Arabs, they were very upset by this because there was a preacher in Saudi Arabia called Muhammad Wahhab. And he said that the Turks and the Barbary pirates had lost their way. They had forgotten about jihad. They were becoming just like the Christians. They were becoming materialistic. And because of that, the Islamic world was suffering. The Muslims have gotten thrown out of Spain. They were defeated in Vienna. The British took over India. Everything was going bad for the Islamic world. So Muhammad Wahhab said, we've got to go back to what our original prophet Muhammad did. We got to go to the old time religion. We have to start chopping off heads. We have to start enslaving people. We have to start, torturing our enemy. We have to subjugate women. We have to do all the stuff that our original prophet Muhammad did back in the 600s and the 700s, a very, very brutal form of Islam. And I always thought that's what you had in Arabia. This guy Wahhab became very close to the Saudi family of warriors in Saudi Arabia. And of course, I thought they were a bunch of nobodies in Arabia until they discovered oil. And then we had our problems. What I did not know until 2 weeks ago, when I read a fascinating book by Charles Allen, is that in 1730, you had an Indian pilgrim, because every Muslim has to go to Arabia once in his or her lifetime. It's called the Hajj. It's a duty of every Muslim. So anyway, you had somebody from India went to Saudi Arabia in 1730. And was so impressed with the teaching of this primitive view of Islam, from Wahhab, he went back to India and he started preaching that throughout India. And as soon as he got back to India in 1730, you had nothing but assassinations, murder, rebellion, all the stuff we read about with Gunga Din and the Bengal Lancers and all that stuff, completely turned India upside down. And finally, the British spent like about a 50-year war to crush the Wahhabs of India with the Bengal Lancers, and they won battle after battle. They just about wiped them out. But a handful of survivors of this Wahhab movement said, you know what? We can't defeat the British Empire. We can't defeat their army. So we're going to stop fighting them for now. We're going to set up this school, and we're going to teach our children and our grandchildren this violent, primitive doctrine. And they set up a school in Deoband, India.
Seth, hold it right there just a moment. We'll come right back. 22 minutes past the hour with Seth Grossman, Executive Director, founder of Liberty and Prosperity. And if you've missed it, check out the podcast later today, because it really is one of the finest presentations that I have heard on this particular era, and the way that I am assimilating all this data and processing it, this information, is that this is the preamble to the conditions that were in effect in September of 1804, when Seth gets to the point that he'll introduce Richard Summers into the discussion. Seth, back to you. Time is yours.
Yes, and I won't repeat the Taliban part, but basically everything I said about how Saudi Arabia fanaticism ends up in India and Pakistan. It's a very thorough documented book by Charles Allen, who basically spent his life in India and Pakistan, called God's Terrorists.
Seth, before you continue your presentation, I have one question for you, because I've been calling the Taliban medieval. They haven't changed. You go back hundreds of years, setting people on fire, burning them alive, raping women to death, beheading people, hanging people, draw and quartering people. I mean, nothing's changed. They're the same animals now that they were then. Would our enemy ever remove their force, if you will, their forces, their military or their forces, leave the citizens in such harm's way, and, oh, by the way, empty all the prisons of all your enemies, and now they're back out in the jihad, and arm the Taliban with, I don't know, 85 billion or so of missiles, 3 million rounds of ammo, Humvees, Apache helicopters, planes, small arms weapons, you name it, they've got it. The enemy would never do such a thing, would they?
Well, the first thing you have to understand, do you know what, I don't want to embarrass you, do you know what the word Taliban means?
I've heard a couple different things, but go ahead, teach us.
All right. It means student or seeker of knowledge. So basically, we have been at war with these students for 20 years, and which in itself is absurd, because you don't go to war with students. Normally, you would go to war with the teachers of those students, right?
Interesting.
And the teachers of those students is the doctrine of Wahhab. The doctrine of Wahhab, and when we talk about the medieval barbarity, it's all deliberate, because what Wahhab taught, he says, if you want to achieve the goals of our prophet Muhammad, which is to take over the entire world, you can't do that by negotiating. You can't do it by being civilized with the Christians. You can't do it with tolerance. You have to do it the way our original prophet Muhammad did it when we took over one-third of the Christian world within 50 years. That's what we have to do.
Well, the students took teacher Joe Biden to the, they just completely rolled him over. They've got two landing strips and a military base and all of our equipment. And they have a fortified area. We have maybe if they'll let us, some access to Bagram in the center of the city that is not protected. And we saw what happened with the bombings and such. So the student completely got full advantage and defeated the teacher, because they rolled Joe Biden right over here.
Well, no, the Taliban are the students of their teachers, the Wahhab doctrine, and where the centers of the Wahhab doctrine? In Pakistan, India, and Saudi Arabia. And basically, who are our main allies in our war against the Taliban? Pakistan, Saudi Arabia. So what we have done, we have supposedly had this war for 20 years, but we're getting all of our advice and strategy from the people who are teaching the Taliban to hate us and to kill us. So, I mean, it's absurd. And let me give you another example.
Yeah.
That the Taliban have been taught that when Islam succeeded, you know, as Islam failed in their view, when they got kicked out of Spain, they got kicked out of Vienna on September 12th, 1683, when the British kicked them out of India. They said, we want to go back to when we conquered the world. And that's when we were barbaric, when people feared us. But they said our greatest enemy, or rather our greatest weapon, was not torture, not force, not killing people, but was deception. That was our prophet's greatest skill.
Right. In their teachings, they're taught they can lie. They're taught to lie, whatever, taqiyya or whatever it's called. That's a big part of their strategy. That's why, isn't it preposterous when we're hearing? I mean, they said this even after we have American dead even after everything that's gone wrong here, and that they have the control of everything, and that we have to ask them permission to get our people out. They said the Taliban has promised us they're going to keep our word after we leave tomorrow. Can you believe that? They're believing the Taliban, who are taught to lie.
Right, right. And again, all this is written because, again, the Taliban have been taught by the doctrine of Wahhab that the only doctrine that counts, there are two books. The Quran, which is, the word of God or Allah is revealed to Muhammad, and what's called the Hadith, the tradition, the words and deeds of Muhammad during his lifetime. So a classic example of this is the Taliban will say, okay, we insist that you get out of this heavily fortified Bagram airport, and we insist that you use the local airport so we can control the checkpoints. And we promise that if you tell us the names of your key people, we will give them passports so they can get to the airport and get out safely. So we give them the names of our key people, and we tell them where they're living, and they round up our key people, they torture them, and they kill them.
Correct.
Now, to us, that's a betrayal of trust. They lied to us. But according to the doctrine of Wahhab, that's exactly what the Prophet did to deal with the unbelievers. So what we think is evil and treacherous, they think is a virtue, and it shows how smart and shrewd they are. And again, this is no secret. I mean, so you ask yourself, well, how come the Biden administration and the Joint Chiefs of Staff and military intelligence and all these experts in the war on terror, they don't know this? But Liberty and Prosperity, a breakfast group that meets at Sal's Cafe every, how come we know that?
It is 36 minutes past the hour. Visiting this morning, this hour, with Seth Grossman, the founder, the executive director of Liberty and Prosperity. Seth, bring it on.
Well, let me remind everybody again, this Saturday, September 4th, the day that Richard Summers died in Tripoli, libertyandprosperity.com is working with Mary Ann Cannon, the artist who did the mural at the Richard Summers Park. We'll be having a ceremony and a storytelling of the Richard Summers story, 9 o'clock Saturday at the park, not the house where his grandfather or great-grandfather lived, right by the Summers Point Circle, but instead across from Charlie's Bar, 801 Shore Road, where you see the mural and the statue of Richard Summers. We'll be there with Mary Ann Cannon, the artist, and she'll explain everything. And then afterwards, by the way, that event is free. We invite everybody to come over after the event to at 10 o'clock to Sal's Cafe on New Road in Groveland Avenue for a $25 buffet to help us pay expenses. In all fairness, the city of Summers Point will be having a separate ceremony on the September 15th birthday of Richard Summers. That's a Wednesday at the same location, 9 o'clock. And the official Summers Point city and historical site presentation is more traditional. They focus on Richard Summers. As you could tell, that we at Liberty and Prosperity focus on the lessons to be learned from Richard Summers. And sometimes that makes us provocative and controversial, and I can fully understand why the city would rather have our presentation separate from theirs, and there's really no hard feelings at all. So anyway, now that I've gotten that out of the way, let me tell you, how did Americans and Richard Summers end up at the shores of Tripoli? And that goes back to when America was founded in 1783. We declared our independence in 1776. But then we fought 5 years for independence from the British. But in 1783, American independence was recognized by the world. And we had such an amazing country back then. First of all, Americans were pacifists. So as soon as the war was over, we got rid of our army, got rid of our navy, had virtually zero military spending. There was almost no local taxes. At the time, the only tax you had was from mostly county government, where you had you couldn't be a freeholder. A freeholder meant landowner. You couldn't be a public official unless you owned land, and the only people who owned land paid taxes. So there were virtually no taxes. You didn't need any licenses or permits. So we had the most robust economy ever seen in world history. So, and you see it, and we learn it from Sally Hastings and the Summers Point Historical Society. So if you go down Central Avenue in Linwood, you see, you have a dam. You have the Bargaintown Pond. Well, somebody built that pond to make the water wheel go round so you could grind your own grain. People built ships. In Europe, you needed a license or a permit to build a ship or to build a dam or to build a water mill. Here, anyone who bought the land could build what they wanted, do what they wanted, absolutely free. And so you had people in Summers Point building ships and taking those ships to China, to India, to England, to Italy, all over the world. And what would they put in those ships? They put American tobacco, furs, skins, salt, meat, grain, whiskey, turpentine, pitch, fish, goods the rest of the world wanted. And they bring back coffee, tea, China, silk, European goods. So we had the biggest, it just within a year or two, we had like the largest merchant fleet in the world. American ships were the fastest in the world because anybody can make their own designs. The American ships could outsail anything produced in France or England or Spain. It was just miraculous. And what happened is, as soon as our American sailors ended up in Italy, ended up in Spain and France, they'd be captured by people we never heard of. And they were the Barbary pirates. And when they would seize our ships, seize the cargo, sell the crews and passengers into slavery, unless we paid a bribe or ransom to get them out. Thomas Jefferson was our ambassador to France. John Adams was our ambassador to England. They asked the Europeans, what do you do with these people? Why are they picking on us? And they were told, oh, yeah, they've been doing this for 1,000 years, but now they're getting soft. If you pay them money, they'll leave you alone, and we'll set up a meeting for you to pay them money. And Thomas Jefferson did that, and basically they tried to negotiate.
And by the way, when you paid the money, you got your people back, correct?
You got your people back, yes.
Let me ask you a question, and I learned this from you a few years ago when we did the same focus. We got to the point where we know we took, whether you want to call it a doctrine, whatever, a position, that we don't negotiate with terrorists because it would just never end. They just keep kidnapping people and you keep paying them and they kidnap, pay, you know, catch and release type crazy stuff. Did Joe Biden violate the doctrine of not negotiating with terrorists with what he was doing with the Taliban? I think he did.
Absolutely. And this was something that Thomas Jefferson warned against in 1785. But in 1785, when Thomas Jefferson did this, we didn't have a constitution. We didn't have a president. We didn't have a navy. And so Congress said, sorry, just pay them what they want. And so every time we paid we can't call them pirates because it was legal. They were legally at war. It was a legal jihad against America. And if we captured them, they were treated as prisoners of war. And so we bought the peace. And the more money we paid to the terrorists, the more they'd buy bigger ships, they'd buy bigger cannons, they'd buy more modern weapons. They demand more money. And finally, Americans had enough. At some point, even the French started stealing American ships and demanding ransom. And that's when Americans went nuts in 1797 and said millions for defense, not 1 cent for tribute. That was when America stopped negotiating with terrorists. And basically 10% of the federal budget for about 10 years was paying bribes and tribute to pirates. And finally, Congress did a typical American thing. They said, you know what? All the money we're paying in bribes, we're going to stop paying, and we're going to use that money to build warships and build a navy. So that's what we did. And the other thing is, remember when President Trump wanted to build a wall to enforce immigration laws?
Yes.
And Congress wouldn't appropriate the money, and people said, well, let's just donate money to build the wall ourselves.
Right.
That's what Americans actually did with our Navy.
And then our government actually said, you can't do that either. This was the same people that were in favor of a wall. They just couldn't be in favor of a wall because it was going to be Trump's wall. But that's true. There was a lot of money raised, and they actually said, you can't do it. They made it illegal for the citizens to be able to do that. Seth, if you have a comment on that comment, when we come back, we have one more segment straight ahead. We'll have about 12 minutes to close things out. Back in a few.
Early in the morning, WPG Talk Radio 95.5 FM and 1450 AM. Listen for the morning edition of the O'Reilly Update with Bill O'Reilly at 10:15 this morning. Now, Harry Hurley on WPG Talk Radio 95.5.
Thank you very much. 49 minutes past the hour with Seth Grossman in the run-up to September 4th, the annual presentation that Seth and his partners do relative to Richard Summers on the date of his death. It's been a very, very listenable hour, Seth. And a reminder, wide open forum. So hang in there on the phone lines, wide open forum coming up for the full 8 o'clock hour, and then Mayor Charles Kane in today's 9 o'clock hour. Seth, about 11 minutes. Time is yours.
Okay, so everything I don't get to is posted somewhere on libertyandprosperity.com. And now, for the first time, we have so much stuff posted on libertyandprosperity.com that we can't fit even half of it on the homepage. So if you don't see a topic you like, we have a search bar, and just put Summers or AAA or something like that, and you could find articles during the past 6 or 7 years giving all the details that I don't get to because I run out of time. But anyway, so after paying 10% of the federal budget to these pirates or to the Barbary, followers of the Prophet Muhammad who feel they have a duty to attack and kill anyone who doesn't believe in their prophet and to enslave them and to take their goods and steal them. But again, they got a little soft because they said, okay, but if you pay us money, we'll leave you alone. After paying 10% of the federal budget for about 12 years, Americans finally say millions for defense, not 1 cent for tribute. We're not going to pay bribes to France. We're not going to pay it to the Barbary pirates. We're going to build a navy. We're going to protect our people. And the interesting thing is Congress did not appropriate enough money to build the ships that were needed. So at that time, you had most of the navy was built by private people. It was called by subscription, where you would have the merchants of Boston would get together and they'd build a warship with private donations and they'd give it to the navy. Same thing with the people of Philadelphia. So I'd say maybe Congress and taxes paid for half of the fleet. The other was paid for by subscription with donations, just like with what people want to do with Trump's wall. And then you had a whole bunch of side deals. People would be investors, would build warships, and they'd say, well, in return, we'll get 20% of any enemy goods or contraband that you capture. So we have a Navy, and then we have young people volunteer for the Navy, and Richard Summers from Summers Point and his two best friends, Stephen Decatur and Charles Stewart, they volunteer. They're the first midshipmen, and their first assignment is to go to war against the French pirates of the Caribbean. And they were totally inexperienced, had no training, but they were bright. They were strong. They wanted to fight. And in a matter of a year, they just clobbered the French. No one had ever seen anything like that because we were supposed to be a bunch of nobodies. Then in 1801, Thomas Jefferson becomes president, and he sends our fleet to North Africa to fight the Barbary pirates. First 2 years are a total disaster. We fight the war against those pirates the same way we fought the war in Afghanistan. We have two failed commanders. One is called Richard Dale. The other one is called Richard Morris. The Barbary pirates did all the tricks that they did to us in Afghanistan. They would put up a, if we'd be ready to capture them, they'd put up a Turkish flag. If we were at war with Tripoli, but not Turkey, then Algeria would declare war on us. And we'd capture an Algerian ship, but they'd run up a Moroccan flag. So they were using all these tricks and deception to keep us from being effective. And we had a commander who didn't want to fight in the winter because the water was too rough in the winter, and he got seasick. Mm-hmm. So we only fought the Barbary pirates in the summer, and needless to say, they got all their supplies in the winter. Finally, of course, the lesson is that America has had in every war is you often start off with bad commanders And the key to winning wars is if you have a commander who's not winning battles, you get rid of him and you put somebody else in. But you'll notice that there's a guy called Thomas Ricks wrote a book. He said, why hasn't America won a war since 1945? And the answer is that we haven't been firing any generals who fail. You know, everybody's in there for a lifetime career. But in any case, it took two failed commodores before we finally get a guy called Preble who takes command, lets young guys like Richard Summers, fight the battles they want to fight, and we win one victory after another. There was one disaster. The Philadelphia, one third of our force, ran aground. 300 Americans captured by the Tripoli pirates. It looked like we had lost the war, and that's where the miracle happens. That's where Richard Summers those young commanders, they replaced the Philadelphia by building and refitting like a whole fleet of new ships that they buy in Sicily. And there's another whole story of Richard Summers basically training a bunch of Italians, where Richard Summers has more Italians working for him than Americans, puts together this fleet of gunboats within 3 or 4 months. They attack Tripoli. They win battle after battle. And it looks like they're on the verge of winning total victory over the pirates. And then suddenly Congress loses interest in the war and says, you know what, we're going to bring everybody home before the job is done. And that's when Richard Summers comes up with this daring mission to end the war by fitting a ship with explosives, sending it to Tripoli Harbor on September 4th, 1804, to destroy the Arab fleet in almost a suicide mission. Something goes wrong. Richard Summers and his entire crew of the Intrepid are killed. And it looks like a total failure. And Thomas Jefferson and Congress say, okay, we failed. We're going to start paying the tribute again. We'll bribe the pirates. It didn't work. And they send the bribe money to the Navy to make peace with Tripoli. And that's when the Navy went rogue. Instead of using the bribe money to surrender, they used the bribe money to hire about 500 Greek mercenaries to land with the Marines on the shores of Tripoli. And they finally won the war. And then the Tripoli said they leave us alone. Americans were respected in the Mediterranean and in the Islamic world for 150 years. Pope Pius VII said that this American nation in its infancy did more to protect Western civilization than the great European powers for centuries. So basically we won a war against the same enemy we're facing now. And some of the things we did, right, we understood our enemy. President Thomas Jefferson read their Quran. Guys like Thomas Jefferson, every time they would capture an enemy ship, they'd interview the crew, find out what motivated them, who was, we made allies, we made enemies. We were just as effective as our enemy was. We appointed and promoted officers based on merit, people who won battles. If you were ineffective, you were removed. You had commanders were given judgment to do the best they could on battlefield conditions. They were not given orders from people 1,000 miles away. There were no rules of engagement. If the enemy put a cannon up in a mosque, they would blow up the mosque. And we made alliances. So all the things that we did wrong in Afghanistan for the past 20 years, we did right and basically won the war in 2 years over there. So that's the lesson to be learned from Richard Summers.
2 minute drill, Seth. Let me say something so I don't miss the opportunity to say this. We've known each other for more than 35 years. You've done a lot. I think I've come to the conclusion, but I've never said it publicly before, your best destiny might be teaching. I have actual messages from people that we both know how much they're enjoying the presentation that you've done this hour. Very, very good. Closing comment, Seth.
Well, I would like to teach, and I'm writing stuff down, but the fact is that my message is politically incorrect. It's not permitted to be taught in Atlantic Cape Community College. I had been teaching there for 5 years. Of course, I was an adjunct. You sit at the pleasure of when they feel like calling you, and suddenly they stop calling me. And of course, I had my application in for Stockton University, but this is not the message that they want to teach to our kids. I've had people say, oh, the Richard Summers story, that would make a fantastic movie. And it would be a movie. But it seems that anything that makes America look good, anything that's positive, of someone who is not a victim of some way, is not allowed to be taught to our young people. It is a tragedy. And I urge everybody to say, you know, the story I'm teaching now, there's an Ocean City Historical Museum. There are libraries. Why isn't the Richard Summers story being taught there? So I urge everybody to help me teach that story by going to your public library, going to your historical society. I'd be happy to give the same presentation I just gave here.
Yeah, shouldn't be politically incorrect. The truth is an affirmative defense. I understand the politics of it all, though. School politics, some of the worst. 20 seconds, Seth. Closing comment.
All right. Well, anyway, I hope everyone will go to libertyandprosperity.com. Again, I urge you, if you like our post, copy and paste our message. Get the word out as soon as much as you can, as often as you can.